The House State Affairs Committee will come to order. Welcome, everybody. This is our first meeting of the committee this year. The same procedures we did last year, and before that, will be done again. And I'm going to start with this morning. We have three items on the agenda. We have the LMR, Alaska Land Mobile Radio Overview. We have the governor's appointee for lieutenant governor's successor. And we have HB 76, which involves legislative council and LBNA membership. I'd like to recognize members of the committee who are here. Representative Peterson, Representative Gernberg, Representative Johnson, Representative Gatto, and Vice Chair Paul Seaton. So is there any preliminary need from the committee at this point? If not, I would invite ALMR folks to come up and tell us about the system. Oh, and I will have to now, I have to testify on one of my bills over in on the dark side in the Senate House State Affairs Committee at approximately 9 o'clock. So when I have to leave for that, Vice Chair Paul Seaton, Representative Seaton, will take over the meeting. Okay, welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Petro, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration, and with me today is Jim Kohler, who is Deputy Director of the Enterprise Technology Services Division within Department of Administration. And for your benefit, he was also formerly the ALMR, or Alaska Land Mobile Radio, Project Manager. So I brought him along to answer all the hardest questions. So this morning, it was just intended to be an update, but we're happy to answer.
Basically an update. Tell us what's developed in this system between the last time we spoke and this morning.
Okay, we will do that, and but we're also happy to answer any questions that you have. In your packets this morning, for those of you less familiar with the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System, you have a white paper and a timeline, which will kind of summarize what we've done to date. There is also in your packet an FAQ, which is an extensive FAQ, but it is a complex system. It also has FAQs in regard to the SAT system, which is the State of Alaska Telecommunication System, on which the Alaska Land Mobile Radio System depends and it rides. So you have some substantial background information there.
Could you just tell us in about five or six sentences, what is ALMR? What does it do that other communication systems don't do?
I'm going to actually let Jim answer that question.
Okay.
And when he gets too technical, I'm going to elbow him.
But I want the non-technical.
Yes.
The Alaska Land Mobile Radio System is a very specific radio communication system designed for public safety first responders. The specific benefit of the ALMR system is it allows full interoperability, so that regardless of who that emergency responder is associated with, they're able to talk to each other on the same radio for the same frequency, whether it's somebody from a local fire department, Alaska State Troopers, Department of Defense, FBI, BLM. Everybody is on the same radio at the same time and can speak with each other, as opposed to having to go through various translations or not being able to communicate with each other in the event of a large-scale event where multiple responders from different agencies have to attend the event. They're all basically able to speak to each other using the same radios.
In my old fighter pilot days, I do mean old, we had a thing called guard channel. And on the guard channel, you could speak to everybody on every frequency and hear what everybody is saying on every frequency. And it came in quite handy when we had to coordinate between different entities.
That's correct. And the challenge with the older systems, and I'm familiar with that as well, is that you do have to frequency hop. And so just because a particular agency is speaking with each other on one frequency, it doesn't mean that folks that at that point in time using a different frequency are hearing them. It all came to a head, even though this project was initiated prior to 9/11. It all came to a head, certainly magnified with the 9/11 disaster, when police and other folks were communicating. Fire responders, you know, inside the towers couldn't hear that. They couldn't hear the message saying, you know, get out, etc., because people were working on those multiple frequencies. This basically eliminates that and also allows an incident commander to be able to speak with all agencies and coordinate that because everybody's using the same handset.
Thank you very much. I'd like to recognize Representative Peggy Wilson has joined us. Go ahead.
So the Alaska Land Mobile Radio project has been a cooperative from the beginning, and when we were last before you, which was January 2008, 2 years ago, we had just signed the cooperative agreement between the state of Alaska, the Department of Defense, and then the non-federal DOD agencies involved in the project. And at that time, Alaska Municipal League had chosen to become an associate member of the cooperative. So I wanted to bring you up to speed on exactly where we are on the build-out. The state has two additional ALMR sites to build out, one in Ketchikan and one in Haines. And we had earlier anticipated that these would be complete by now, but there was a site change in Haines and then a U.S. Forest Service permit delay in Ketchikan. We anticipate both of those sites to be complete by the end of August.
Is there a connection, for example, on the site in Haines and the Canadian forces or Canadian agencies?
At this point in time, the answer is yes and no. Yes, it is possible to be able to speak with Canadian personnel. We say that because within the last few weeks, we executed a demonstration project to see if, in fact, using some adjunct equipment that we have put on our system, they are called motobridges, where you can link disparate systems together to try to talk to each other. We were able to execute a conversation between a trooper in Alaska, public safety officials in the state of Oregon, and a Mountie in British Columbia. It sounds simple, but this was the second attempt. The first attempt about a month previous, again, we're just working out some of those technical bugs, just trying to get the communications to work. But as of a few weeks ago, we demonstrated that it would be possible, that if we had to, there would be limited conversation. It wouldn't be the full bells and whistles that we have in our ALMR system, but it would be possible to link a conversation Northwest, state of Washington, state of Oregon, British Columbia, as well as responders in the state of Alaska.
And the Yukon?
That's correct. The fact that we could link to the British Columbia Mountie means simply that we could use the same technology and we could speak with somebody in Whitehorse or, you know, as long as they had a radio signal. That's correct. Very limited.
Yeah.
But
better than
possible.
Than nothing. Okay.
That's correct.
So progress there. And the last time we met, we had promised a total cost of ownership. We had discussed that it was going to be completed. It was completed in August of that year, and it was shared with then committee members. just to highlight that, you have an executive summary in your packet today. The full study is online. But the TCO did three things. It identified and quantified future O&M costs for the ALMR system, which of course is of primary concern, and that estimate is at $5.5 million a year. And as we get into costs this year, we're right about there, actually just under that amount. So the TCO also put the O&M costs in context with other similar systems. And similar is kind of an interesting thing in this case because there is no exact parallel system anywhere in the world, but they are similar systems, and the TCO and even the executive summary kind of outlines some of those differences. So it's not an apples to apples comparison, but you can see where they tried to get at more a closer comparison. And thirdly, the TCO documents the actual cost of the ALMR system through June 30, 2008. And the total cost, as articulated in the white paper, is 150, and the TCO is $151 million for a total of 81 sites. The TCO also accounts for the Anchorage wide area network, AWARN, their 15 sites, $193 million. Also, since our last briefing to this committee, an economic analysis was conducted, and that looked at two primary things. One was keeping the ALMR cooperative intact or dividing it into separate entities. And so the analysis conducted an independent validation for cost reasonableness and across the system, and they benchmarked with two other systems. And one was the Pacific Land Mobile Radio in Hawaii, and then the Fort Lewis Mobile Radio in Washington. The conclusion was that it would be more costly for independent entities within the state of Alaska to create separate interoperable land mobile radio systems than to maintain the cooperative Alaska Land Mobile Radio System. All the major stakeholders were interviewed and were part of this economic analysis, state of Alaska, Department of Defense, but also municipal users. There were one-on-one interviews. It's very important to note that the ultimate conclusion of this economic analysis was that the total benefit and capability of this interoperable system could not be obtained separately by any of the major stakeholder groups currently partners in the ALMR system, considering the build-out and the sustainment costs of such systems. So moving on to current ALMR funding, the governor has proposed in his FY11 budget to cover the costs for both the municipal and the state of Alaska agency per radio handset costs. So that is in the governor's budget this year. Also wanted to highlight the fact that we have worked with our partners to reduce the ongoing maintenance costs, particularly in the what we call the OMO, or the Office of Management
and Operations.
Oh, there's all these acronyms. Excuse me.
I'm going to outlaw those someday.
The OMO, the costs, we are pleased that we are able to reduce those costs, $150,000, going from $629,000 in FY09 to $440,000 in fiscal year 10, the fiscal year we're in right now, and we're looking at $450,000 going in, it proposed for FY11. So that's just a highlight on where we are from state. Now to the heart of the issue, there have been some rumors circulating about federal support diminishing for the ALMR system. So let me share with you what we've been told from our DoD partners. Colonel Hayes, who is the Department of Defense's ALMR Executive Council representative, has explained as recently as last Thursday to the Executive Council that there is a fundamental procurement conflict within DoD when it comes to supporting the ALMR system in the future. So originally, DoD's support for the ALMR project originated with a direct mission-related need for munitions transport along the highway system, and that need no longer exists today. That is in direct conflict with DoD's directive from Homeland Security to support civil authorities. So Colonel Hayes has assured the Executive Council that he is working with his counterparts and authorities within DoD and all the agencies that are involved there to resolve these issues. He was not able to be here today or available online, but he is the contact for the federal DoD partnership. Some good news in all of this is that because the Alaska Land Mobile Radio is the most mature cooperative that has effectively followed the national guidance for P25 standards to achieve the single standards-based shared system, the Office of Emergency Communications within the federal Department of Homeland Security is going to conduct a study on ALMR, and this study will document the legal, regulatory, and fiscal contracting barriers, which have been many. I mean, if you might recall, this project began, the first concept was in the early 90s, and here we are in 2010, and we're not, I mean, we are operating today, and we are successful, but it has taken us a long time to overcome these barriers, and now I just told you there's another federal barrier. So this OEC, the Office of Emergency Communications, is going to begin this study, identifying those barriers, and also identifying the successful approaches that ALMR cooperative partners have used to resolve these. And then finally, in my mind, the best part is that the Office of Emergency Communications is dedicated to putting a plan together to resolve the barriers that ALMR faced so that others around the country, local, state, and federal cooperatives that would like to get started, will not face those same barriers as they go forward and develop their interoperable systems.
Any questions from the committee at this point? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did I say there were how many sites in Anchorage?
The Anchorage municipality has 15 sites. 12 of them are currently built. 3 remain to be built.
And a cost of $10 million apiece?
I'll let Jim speak.
Let's say $190 million, just roughly, was where, you know, divided by 10, just sort of pulled the number out of my head.
Yeah, through the chair, if I may. The construction of the ALMR system, exclusive of the separate system that the municipality of Anchorage is building out, the cost for that system was the $150 million-plus that Deputy Commissioner Petro related. When you add in the municipal cost of building that separate system within the municipality of Anchorage, which was approximately $30 million, that brings the total cost of an entire interoperable system to the $190 million level. So the municipality of Anchorage is spending close to $30 million for their entire system. So that's how we get to the 190.
So the cost is $10 million a site, regardless who pays for it, roughly. A little more than that.
Well, through the chair, again, if I may, the Anchorage system, if we look at it separately, will have 15 sites at approximately $30 million. Included in that are the costs of all the handsets. So 15 sites, approximately 600 to 700 handsets. Each handset is approximately $5,000 a piece. So the per site cost is, closer to about $750,000 plus all the additional costs for handsets and equipment and other related expenses.
So, and that leads me to my next question. I look here on the list, and I don't see any handsets for Anchorage.
On the municipal and NGO list, that is correct. And I'm going to let Jim explain the nuances of that, because the municipality of Anchorage is a partner, but they don't participate in the cost share portion because they own their own equipment. And sure. If I'm missing something, Jim's going to jump in. And so that's why they're not reflected on that list.
Okay, but before you jump in, include in your explanation how the handsets are figured in the cost if the municipality owns their own system. So kind of work me through the numbers of how that works. That's a little confusing to me. We're budgeting for it, but they own it. Help me.
Yeah, through the chair, if I may. I understand the confusion, because even internally we wrestle with this at times. The municipality of Anchorage is building and operating their own interoperable communication system. That was a desire that they expressed, and when we were building the ALMR system, but we have built both systems so that the Anchorage responders, their handsets work on our system, our responders' handsets work on their system. Okay? So we have a single interoperable system. But because the municipality is building and maintaining their own system, and their users at times need our system to operate, our users at times need their system to communicate and operate, we have an agreement that we're just simply not going to charge each other for using each other's systems as we need to. So the handset list that you see in your packet are the lists of all the municipalities within the ALMR system that we need to support. Anchorage is its own separate system. They're funding their own handsets differently through their own revenue sources. So that the municipality of Anchorage is not relying on any ALMR funding for their system. So handset support, as well as the maintenance and construction of their system, is a funding-resourced project separate from any funding flowing through the state or federal government to the ALMR system.
I think I have some more questions. In light of the budgetary situation that Anchorage finds itself in today, do you expect them to come to us and ask for assistance in this?
Through the chair.
$200 million is still, you know, that's a lot of money, and that's how short.
We have not heard that from the municipality. You know, again, they own their own system. We have not heard that from them, but we've heard no such requests. That's all I can say. We've not ever heard them come to ask for money.
Mr. Chairman, would it be reasonable for them to come to you, since everyone else in the state has been funded? Would it be reasonable for them to come to you and ask assistance in light of their $200 million deficit in the immediate future?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, well, the test of reasonableness will end with the legislature, because you appropriate the funds. But again, Anchorage Municipality invested in the infrastructure, and, you know, I would encourage you to talk to the municipality. I'm uncomfortable speaking on their behalf, because they have not at all approached us about this.
Okay, let's put it in a hypothetical. If they were to have approached you, or in the future approach you, and I hope I'm not giving anybody any ideas, what would be the response when they come to you and said, everyone else in the state has received help? We haven't. We've shared it with you. Now we need some help.
We would have those discussions, and Representative Johnson, we would have those discussions with them, and ultimately, again, we would be having those discussions with you all.
Nobody knows what municipality might do.
Chairman, I think we're going to get that discussion.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have basically four areas of inquiry. First, I'm looking at this list, folks. This is the list, I think, that's been referred to, and that's the one I'm looking at. For example, I see that the Juneau Police Department is a member, but not the Juneau Fire Department. Why is that, and how many other emergency responders are not on your list, and why?
Through the chair, I'd like Jim Kohler to respond to that.
Yeah, through the chair, if I may. I leave decisions that have been made locally on who within their own public safety responders they are adding to the system and not. But generally speaking, the City and Borough of Juneau is an example of an agency that is maturing and into the system. At this point in time, are bringing their police department onto the system, and as they grow internally, I fully expect that the entire public safety operations within the City and Borough of Juneau will be on the system. But they are coming onto the system much later and much more recently than other entities, for example, the City of Fairbanks, the Borough of Fairbanks, etc., who have been in the system and have matured their relationship with the system extensively. So just because the City and Borough of Juneau, for example, equips only part of their public safety operations at this point in time, that doesn't mean that there has been a decision that that's the only part of the public safety they are bringing on. They're learning how to use the system. They're trying to figure out how best to integrate that within their own public safety operations, and so they're taking it on a step kind of approach.
Let me follow up, please.
Follow up.
Representative Johnson said the MOA, the Municipality of Anchorage, is not part of this. We've just talked about the Juneau Fire Department not being part of this. Who else is not part of this?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there anybody not on this list is not a member.
My question is, who's not on the list?
All living Alaskans.
I'm not. Everyone. I mean, seriously, folks, we're being asked to overview and fund this system. And I'm interested in knowing who's not part of this. And if you can get us a list, I'd like to know who's not on the list. A list of people, organizations that are emergency responders in the state. Is there anybody else major who's not? I see all kinds of people from Fairbanks are on. But as we've said, if through the chair, if we could just get that. Because obviously you can't necessarily respond in writing. With respect to the Municipality of Anchorage, who pays for that if the Municipality of Anchorage owns it? Are there state funds? Are there federal funds? Do you folks know? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Jim is shaking his head. Yes, he knows a little bit about this, but it is the taxpayers of Anchorage and probably some federal dollars. And Jim, can you be more specific?
Yes, through the chair, if I may. The vast majority, I would estimate it in the 95% plus range, of the dollars to build out the Municipality of Anchorage system, including the cost of all their handsets, has been acquired through federal grant funding.
Okay.
I'm assuming that there are some dollars just out of necessity for managing and doing those kinds of things, but it's been primarily federally funded.
Okay. Next, very briefly, Mr. Chair, we have in the next page this timeline. The timeline, however, only goes to 2009. We're in 2010. Do you have a timeline in the future? What's happening?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, thank you. Good question. We are in 2010. As I mentioned earlier, there are two ALMR sites that will be completed in 2010. So when we come before you again, we might have to shrink this down or get a larger piece of paper, but there'll be 2010 there. Also, there are three Anchorage municipal sites, the A-Warren sites, that need to be completed, and those would be reflected as part of the overall interoperable system. So 2010, we're going to complete those sites, and I can't think of any other major benchmarks. Perhaps the Office of the OEC study completion, and perhaps some of their addressing and their plans and addressing those at the federal level. Perhaps that will be another milestone here.
And I just have one more question.
Okay.
Here. It's actually kind of a dual part. What percentage is paid by the federal government, and what assurance do you have that federal funding will be continuing?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, excellent question. Gets to the heart of the handouts in front of you that are the pie charts.
Yeah, saw that.
There are basic infrastructure costs, which are funded by the major partners, the DOD and the state of Alaska. Those are basically the core infrastructure costs. And then there are the shared costs, which are the per radio cost. Now, I'm going to let Jim walk you through the cost share and those handouts to give you more information there. Jim?
Thank you again through the chair. The deputy commissioner outlined a basic structural feature of ALMR that's critical to understand. There are two costs ongoing with the ALMR project. One is the actual maintenance of the ALMR equipment, just making sure it works. And the responsibility for maintaining the equipment rests with the individuals that own the equipment. And those costs are not elevated up and then distributed across all users. the cost of the infrastructure maintenance is about $3.2 million projected for FY11. The state-owned equipment that the state of Alaska pays for and maintains is about $1.3 million of that. So the Department of Defense owns the balance of the equipment, and they are independently spending approximately $1.8 million just to maintain the equipment they own. In addition to just making sure the equipment works, there is another set of costs, and that's the actual operation of the system. These are costs associated with monitoring the system, making sure that it is working as a network, and managing the use of the system by all of the parties. Those are what we refer to as the shared costs. Those are the costs that are distributed across all users. And the shared cost is a little over $2 million, about 2.1. So when we speak of shared costs, those are the costs that ultimately the Executive Council sits and works collectively on how are we going to share those costs, how are we going to make sure that everybody participates at that level. So the Department of Defense, in terms of their percentage of infrastructure costs, $1.8 million of approximately 3.1 to 3.2, whatever that percentage is. State of Alaska is the balance. The shared costs would be distributed across approximately 13,500 handsets that are currently using the system. And one of the pie charts that you have is how many handsets each of the four major stakeholders have. So the Department of Defense has about 46% of the handsets. So the original cost share approach was, well, they would pay for 46% of these shared costs, etc. So anyway, at any rate, that particular pie chart is critical because it shows you from a shared cost perspective who owns how many handsets. Now, the assuredness, the second part of your question, the assuredness of ongoing funding, all parties, all of the four stakeholders, you know, at meet and work at the Executive Council level, and as per, again, stated within the cooperative agreement that everybody has agreed to and signed, is that we have promised each other that when we calculate what the costs will be for operating and maintaining the system next year out, we all commit to go back to our funding authorities and request the dollars so we can bring those dollars to the table. So the extent to which the Department of Defense in Alaska, the combined Alaska Command of Army and Air Force, they have always been at the table committed to seek and try to get from their funding authorities the dollar it takes to participate in the ongoing operation. So the extent to which that we don't appropriate money to ourselves, all we can do is pledge that we will always go in and seek the dollars it takes to maintain the system. So that's the most assuredness that I can basically offer.
Thank you very much for that complete answer.
Yeah.
Representative Wilson, that'll be followed by Representative Gatto.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question goes back to this page with all the municipalities on it. I'm looking at the numbers of the handsets that different areas have, and I realize that they're probably trying to, I mean, some committee or somebody decided on how many each area got. And I'm looking at Juneau with 30,000 people, and then I'm looking at Tok with 2,000 at the height of the tourist season. But I used to live there, so I know that it goes back down to about 800 during the rest of the year. Now, There are five native villages that surround Toke that have to be taken care of. How did they come up with the numbers, and what was the data that they used?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, excellent question. And the short answer is that the local entities decide how many radios that their responders need. Jim, can you speak more to
sure,
the local decisions
there? Sure, if I can. And again, through the chair, Representative Wilson, the deputy commissioner is correct. No one within the ALMR project or system allocated handsets to municipalities based on any kind of formula. Municipalities have secured the funding for their handsets, usually from outside sources, primarily federal sources. But they determine how many handsets they want within their system, and they come to us and say, you know, we're going to buy X number of handsets, and then we bring them onto the system. So those are all entirely local decisions. If the city and borough of Juneau said, we're going to put 1,000 handsets on the system, we bring them onto the system, set it up, make sure they work, etc. But those are entirely calculated and determined at the local level. There has been no overlay of any kind of an allocation scheme, etc., that is imposed on any user within the system.
So if they can get the money somehow, because there's no city council, there's no mayor, there's no taxes, there's no money for them to do anything. So they have to get all their money from the feds or from the state or whatever. And so I'm trying to think, there is a local fire department, volunteers, and a local EMS system, volunteers, and there's probably one trooper that covers that whole area, which is huge, I have to admit. But 42 is pretty amazing. And so I guess I'm just saying, there's probably some of these areas that got quite a few of these, and they're pretty expensive, and maybe it could have went over a bigger area and would have stretched into some of the rural areas, or the coastal areas, I should say. And so now all of these on this list already have them?
Through the chair, that is correct. These are actual handset numbers as of the end of the year, end of 2009.
Could you tell me how did they come and decide on what brand is it, for instance? What brand? I mean, somebody's making a lot of money, because at $5,000 a pop, that's humongous. And so what company is getting all this?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, originally there's some technical standards that are required in the radio. And originally, probably 10 years ago, there was one company that produced a radio, and that was Motorola. Today there are, I believe, three or four different entities producing P25 capable radios, and we have all of those types of radios on our system. Jim, you have a
that's correct. And again, through the chair, just to take that one level down further, there are now, as the deputy commissioner indicated, about four vendors manufacturing handsets that function at this level of that is demanded by our system. We just simply test those handsets. If a vendor wants to sell them within the state of Alaska, all we ask is that we be allowed to test them, just so that we can let people know that, yes, this handset worked with all of the features that the system allows. Some handsets have more bells and whistles than others, so you can make decisions at what level of handset you want. So we don't support any particular handset. We just simply make sure that we put them through the drills so that we can turn around any potential handset user and say, we use the handset, it works basically, you know, as advertised.
I follow-up.
You want me to? Go ahead.
I guess I just kind of feel, okay, there's four groups, four different companies that are making these. Is anyone kind of check anything out to make sure that they, you know, government contracts probably or something. I don't know how that works, but that they're couldn't be bringing it down a little bit cheaper. I don't know how you do those type of things, but
any kind of, what's the bidding process for these? How do you decide company A versus company B versus company C and D's?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, there's two questions there, and let me take yours first, Representative Wilson. Again, the cost, I believe, has come down a little bit since there are now four different manufacturers that work on the ALMR system. As the P25 capability expands, in other words, as people build out systems across the United States, there'll be demand and supply, and just normal economics will likely bring the cost down, like we've seen in all technologies. But 10 years ago, cost was high, very limited amount. Now we have more vendors, so as we have more vendors enter the market, hopefully costs will come down. In regard to Representative Lynn, your question in regard to how they procure, each municipality would procure those differently, and the state would follow state procurement standards as far as going out to procure radios for state entities. Jim may be able to tell you about the contract that we currently have. I'm not sure.
So each municipality, et cetera, decides which brand they would like to have.
Correct.
And I assume these brands are at different prices, and whatever they choose, everybody else pays for. Am I missing something?
Through the chair. Each municipality, they decide how many radios they would like. And, of course, they know how much they have to spend, whether that be a grant or, through some other revenue source. I can't speak to their, I can't speak for government municipalities, but they would, yes, they could buy whatever would work on the
any
system.
One of the four that they would choose.
The system itself and the state and the federal, the folks who own the infrastructure, we test those radios to make sure that they will work on the system. We communicate that to municipalities who are interested in buying radios. We don't tell them which one to purchase. We just say, there are four different brands here of radios that will work on the system.
Well, because like a Mercedes and a Honda will both work on the road system.
Correct. if I may,
yes.
Through the chair, Jim, you wanted to add?
Yeah, again, Mr. Chairman, I bring you back to one comment I made a little earlier that's critical to understand, and that is that the way the ALMR project is set up is that if you own the equipment, you are responsible for maintaining it. That's true with handsets. In other words, this project, the budgeting that you see for ongoing operation and maintenance costs, etc., does not include any handset cost, either for acquisition or their maintenance. That is the full responsibility of the entity coming onto the system. They're responsible for securing their handsets, their own revenue sources. It is not through this project. Now, I will tell you that the majority of local handsets have been purchased through various federal grants that have come down through the Division of Homeland Security within the state's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And so that distribution of dollars using federal grants, like I said, has basically funded the majority of local handset costs. But the cost of the handset, either purchase or its maintenance, is not a part of any shared cost or budgetary item within the ALMR project that we bring to you and discuss to you in terms of the budget issues.
Representative Wilson, anything else for now?
Not right now.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could I buy a handset?
How much money do you make?
Representative Gatto, I think you could.
Okay. So the confidentiality portion means to me that the newspapers and the radio stations and whatnot might want to buy a handset and keep track of situations that they want to put their commercial equipment onto.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, you could buy a handset, but I didn't say we'd put you on the system. There is a difference. So you could buy a handset. There's nothing prohibiting that. But to be set up on the ALMR system, we would have to set you up, and it is secure. It is a secure system, so media is not part of that secure. It's public safety oriented.
Okay, I'm going to follow up. I noticed that this all on this timeline. It all starts in 1997 with the Executive Council Charter. I'm not sure what the executive. Who's the Executive Council?
You're stretching the limits of my knowledge of the ALMR system through the chair, Representative Gatto. In all reality, discussions about the ALMR system and those concepts started actually earlier than 1997. The first tangible outcome of that work was the initial MOU to work together towards building this interoperable system. And with that, Representative, I'd like to ask Jim, can you fill in any more blanks there than I can?
I would like to devote about another 5 or 6 minutes because we have two other important items on the thing. And you've been very, very good in responding, attempting at least to respond to our question. So I'm not trying to cut you short, but this may not be the end. Go ahead.
Yeah, if I could, through the chair, Representative, when we refer to the Executive Council, we are referring to representatives from 4 major entities that, as the Deputy Commissioner indicated, came together in 1997 to figure out how we could come together and achieve this system. And those were the Department of Defense, State of Alaska, representatives from municipalities, and all of the non-DOD federal agencies. The Executive Council seats one person from each of those entities, and that Executive Council is the one that has the governance authority on how the project ultimately was built out, how it will continue, preparation of budgets, et cetera.
And I'm going to continue if I can, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So in 1996 was arguably the most significant or a major significant issue, and that was the Miller's Reach fire. And I was on that fire for the whole time as a member of the Anchorage Fire Department. I did not see a difficulty with communications. There was a command center in Anchorage, communicating with the command center at the high school, and the battalion chiefs and the captains and everybody else was given orders to do things at certain times in certain places to accomplish their mission. And that was a fairly major incident. And still, what we're doing here is, we always say better communications. Who doesn't want better communications? But inside of a fire truck, there's a lot of radios. Inside of an airplane, there's a lot of radios. We all have cell phones. And the cell phones are free, relatively speaking. I can call a captain somewhere else on my cell phone. And yet we built out a system with 91 areas built out so far, starting with philosophies back in the 90s, and we're now in the next century, wondering, is this something that maybe reminds me of a Commodore 64 and saying, where are we today with something that we were thinking about so far back, and here it is 2010, and we're meeting here to talk about it, something that we started so long ago, spent a great deal of money. Now we have this issue of handsets. Now we've got maintenance. Now we've got operations. And now I'm wondering if the system that's currently in place hasn't really served us well, and that maybe, think about this, maybe we should abandon this system. That's where I'm going in my head What are we getting for what we're giving? And should we continue on this road when maybe there's a super six-lane freeway available that we haven't yet investigated, and here we're on a country road? Don't know.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm going to make a couple of notes, and then I'll ask Jim to respond further. But the technology, your concern about, gosh, this project started, you know, a decade ago, more than a decade ago, where are we today? Is it old technology? The answer is, this is not old technology. This is, for the P25, the federal single standards-based system, we are at the top of the heap, so to speak. So I want to assure you that we're not dealing with old technology. With that, Jim, do you have anything to add?
If I could, and again through the chair, Representative, very astute questions. Fundamentally, what we get is a system that allows every potential public safety responder type of agency in the state of Alaska to communicate with each other in the event of an incident that requires a full range of multi-agency response. Regardless of the fact that this is the current technology, a full digital trunking system, the other thing we get is the ability to overlay a system so everybody can talk to each other on the same phone, and in a way that we could not do differently. And the basic thing I really want you all to understand is that any system requires frequencies. You have to have so many frequencies to be able to build your system. The state of Alaska does not have enough frequencies allocated by the Federal Communication Commission to be able to set up and operate a communication system across even the entire road system that we have built out now. The Department of Defense can't. It takes everybody bringing the frequencies they have to the table, pooling them and making them work. And we, in fact, the project had to seek, and we gained a waiver from the FCC that allowed us to pool all of these particular frequencies that we have, so we had a single system that could rely on a larger pool of frequencies. And within the economic analysis study that is a part of your particular packet, it goes into more detail in terms of the relationship, in terms of what options anybody on the federal side, the state side, local side would have if, in fact, they did not pool the frequencies we have to try to overlay this kind of a system. So
if I may, I'm going to have to excuse myself for the other hearing. Vice Chair Seaton is going to take the gavel here momentarily, and I know that Representative Grunberg may be asking something sent to us. And just as a note in passing, I had the pleasure of meeting with Commissioner Hartig yesterday. I'm very pleased from what I heard when we had our private conversation, not before the committee, so I apologize for not being here, sir, but I would put on the record that I'm very pleased from what I've heard so far of your qualifications for the office. So with that, Vice Chair Seaton, will you please take over the meeting here? And thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Who was next in line here?
You're next.
I'm next. Okay. Okay.
If you want to call on yourself, you can.
Good. And then we have Peterson, Grunberg.
I'll come at last.
Representative Johnson, did you have your hand up?
Not yet.
Okay. Thank you. I had a question. First of all, you know, kind of following up on Representative Gatto's question about the technology and all. I mean, we just saw this huge situation in Haiti, and yet there was communications to the United States to Haiti, but it was through cell phones and cell phone pictures and everything, you know, which is, you know, 10 years ago we didn't even have any of these kind of smartphones or any of the kind of communications. So as we look through these things, I would appreciate you also getting back to us, because there's a number of questions that people have that they want to get back. So I think that the committee would probably like to further this conversation. So I would like to find out whether there were any P-25 capable systems in Haiti. I mean, we had the UN was there, and we had military. Did their systems go down, and basically did commercial systems that were basically very cheap handsets, did they maintain their integrity and the availability for communications? Because if I can assume if we have communications from Haiti to New York and Atlanta and other media centers, that that same kind of communication would come back to the same area. I guess part of my question is, how many of these municipalities or units are using these as a primary communication vehicle currently? Because I've gotten information from the small people that I represent that one of the big problems is that, okay, they've gotten these radios. Basically, they signed on with a free government grant, and they have these things. They don't use them as their primary communication. And so when they're trying to do this interoperability, it's a system they're not used to using, and so that the first responders don't have good communications. Is that the case across many of the smaller units in the state, and how is that in the large units as well? Is the municipality of Anchorage, is this their replacement of their entire radio communication system? Or if you could fill us in on that, please.
Representative Seaton, excellent questions. We recommend that folks use this as their day-to-day radio for the very reason you cite, is you do not want to be in an emergency situation and be fumbling around trying to remember the skills that you learned with that particular radio. When you use it day-to-day, of course, it becomes easier to use in an emergency situation. That said, I'm going to ask Jim to address, you alluded to some local communities not using it as their day-to-day, and then you asked a specific question about the municipality of Anchorage. I don't know that. I'll defer to Jim.
Thank you. And again, Mr. Chairman, it is the rare exception, and really only in the case of small local communities where there are some exceptions, that the ALMR handset is not the day-to-day radio system. I put it in the 98-99% general area of the handsets on the system, whether they're the Department of Defense, whether they're State of Alaska, through Troopers, Department of Transportation, DNR, through most of the municipalities, municipal users and NGO users, for example, the City Fairbanks, the Rural Fairbanks, even the municipality of Anchorage, these handsets are the day-to-day primary handset. One of the challenges that all users on the municipal side face, and some of the small communities that may not be using their ALMR handset as their day-to-day communication face, is that by December 31st of 2011, all of the local municipalities, State of Alaska, etc., within the state, have to have converted to what they call a narrowband frequency for their public safety radio operations. And so if there's a small community or any community that is not using the ALMR system as their day-to-day radio, by December 31st, 2011, they will have had to reconstruct their separate local system to meet those new standards. The ALMR radio and the ALMR system meets those narrowband requirements, and that's one of the reasons that most users, if not all users, by the end of 2011, will be using this radio as their daily handset, because it means they don't have to invest in their small system to build it to a completely different frequency base to meet those FCC narrowband requirements. Short answer is that there are some smaller communities out there that do not use this as their day-to-day system.
And do you anticipate that with only these few number of states, Colorado and us, and I mean, the chart's pretty short of ones that have gone on to this. You anticipate the FCC is going to just pull the plug on all the other states' radios in December 31st, 2011?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. The narrowband mandate was actually issued by the FCC in around 1990 to 1992 when they started reforming frequencies. And in fact, they have delayed and delayed probably three times what that final drop-dead deadline is. And now that the equipment has been out there for as long as it is, we have seen nothing from FCC to indicate that they're going to waver from beginning to enforce the narrowband mandate beginning January 1, 2012.
Thank you. Let's see, we had Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to go back to the transmission towers. You said that we're going to be building around 15 of those in Anchorage. Now, are these towers, do they work on a line-of-sight type of technology? And if we would have an earthquake, say a big one, which we hope would never happen, but you know, you have to be prepared for, and one or two or more of these towers went out, would that cause the system to go down?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, Anchorage Municipality currently has 12. They have three more to complete. And I'm going to let Jim speak to this, but the ALMR and I'm not sure if AWARN is the same, but they ride on other towers that exist for other communication purposes. And line of sight, the answer is yes, but I'll let Jim answer more technically.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. If I may, Representative Peterson, excellent questions and certainly lying at the core of how this system has been designed and the challenges that we face. Short answers to your question. Yes, the entire system is a wireless radio handset communication system, and it relies on line of sight, just as does cell phones. In the case of the municipality of Anchorage, we do have some ALMR sites in Anchorage. So if the if there was some catastrophic event and some sites that the municipality of Anchorage has to support their system went out, we do have some ALMR coverage that covers, you know, areas of Anchorage. Their handsets work on the ALMR system, so they could still use our system as a partial redundancy. It would not be as complete. It would not be as expansive as having their entire system up and operational. But there is a redundancy fallback. Vice versa, if we lost a key ALMR site, for example, we have one at the, on top of the Atwood building in downtown. If we lost that particular tower, but the municipality of Anchorage system was functional with sites in that area, our radios could be picked up and used by their sites. So there is some redundancy within Anchorage, but it is not 100% redundancy.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Peterson.
Just to follow up a little bit on what Representative Gatto had talked about, a person couldn't go to some sort of an electronics online site and buy something similar to a police band radio today and monitor this system? And is that the reason that we're spending all this money, is because it is a highly secure system? I'm assuming with the Department of Defense involved that and Homeland Security, that the reason they're rolling this system out is because it is a secure line and citizens can't be listening along, so to speak.
Representative Peterson, through the chair, you are correct. Now, I will say anything in technology is possible. We see it every day. But in addition to the DOD security standards, the state actually has higher security standards. I think it's 147 individual security points that we have meet and we maintain for that very reason. So, yes, and security does cost money, and security changes daily, and it's not to say that it couldn't be breached, because anything, again, is possible, but it is a highly sophisticated system with many points of security.
Thank you. And follow up on Representative Peterson's question there. You'd stated wireless handset line of sight, and I'm just trying to figure out. So what do we mean by handset? I mean, we have all the police cars and fire engines and everything is installed in those. Are we just talking about the shoulder mounted, or are we talking about just mobile sets?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the question and the opportunity to be a little bit more accurate and specific. We get caught up internally with our own jargon. A handset really does reference any type of that communication equipment, whether it's a mounted unit within a mobile vehicle, whether it is a small hand carry handset, etc. You're correct. There are different types of actual radio units that exist on the system. We just have sunk into the habit of saying handset, meaning any of that radio equipment, regardless of how it's deployed and structured across the system.
Okay, and I guess just following up on that, and mainly these systems, I mean, like if we're talking about some of these that have 10 or 12 or whatever, are these, what's the mix? Do most of these agencies have, I mean, every policeman that's wearing a vest and has a set with him, is that one of these compatible units, or is it something different?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, in the majority of cases, the public safety officials that are on the system are using a hand-carried handset, approximately that size. But depending upon the nature and size of the organization, some will also have a unit mounted in a select number of command vehicles, for example, some fire trucks, so that incident commanders have access to that radio-mounted type of operation. But the majority of what's out there, are these individual, we call it a handheld unit that folks are carrying around.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Chair, Chair Lynn and I chatted momentarily, and I also mentioned to Representative Wilson, we were going to ask some questions for additional data. I'm not totally sure what questions the members want to ask or what I want to ask, and I'm going to talk to my staff about that. You guys have done a really good job. This is a very technical issue, and I'm not an expert in this at all. I'd like to request of the chair that the members be given a couple of days to get some written questions to the staff, and then we'll send written questions to you and get written answers, because I don't want to do this on the cuff. I think this is too technical, and I'd like to make that request, Mr. Chair.
Yes, and I think that that's in line with what Representative Lynn would like to do as well. I mean, there's a number of issues here, as well as budgetary items. I mean, it may be in the governor's budget this time, but I know that in some of my small communities, just the LMR fees were more than their annual budget for operating the volunteer fire department. And so if those things would fall out of a budget, we could have significant impacts across a lot of places in the state. So I think that would be good. We have a couple more people in queue here, and then what we'll do is ask everyone to submit detailed questions to the chairman's office, and then we'll get those to you for further response. And we have Representative Gatto.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. In my days as a paramedic, and I worked Eagle River, and we had a rescue on the river, and we went up the river on both sides, and talking to the guy on the other side by voice, because to operate the phone, had to go back to Anchorage to come back to him. Does your system have direct accessibility when you can see the other person, or does it have to go to a tower and then back to that person?
If I could, through the chair, Representative, the system operates just like a cell phone system. If you speak into it, that signal goes to a tower and then ultimately gets directed to the person that you're directing that conversation to. Now, in this particular case, this system, the trunking system, digital trunking system, the time it takes for that signal to go through that system and get to the individual's handset across the river is roughly at the speed of light. So you will not notice any type of voice delay. But it is correct. You have to go through a system. It goes to a switch, gets sent back, et cetera. That's correct.
Just a brief follow-up.
Brief follow-up. Representative Gatto.
So your reliability is equal to a cell phone's as far as being able to communicate.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand the question.
If I pulled out my cell phone and tried to talk across the river, and it went to Anchorage but was blocked by mountains, and I had no way to communicate except to scream, and your system is the same, that if I can't get straight across the river and it's got to go to some tower somewhere before it gets back to him, that's the same reliability. Am I correct in assuming that?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, that's correct. That's what line of sight operation means. That's
Thank
correct.
You.
Okay, we have Representative Johnson and Representative Wilson, and then we'll conclude. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I had to slip out. And I realize this is an overview. Did we talk about the budget request while I was out of the room?
No.
Did we know how much is in the governor's budget for this year?
The total, Representative Johnson, through the chair. The governor's request includes approximately $660,000 projected for state of Alaska handset use, as well as the $376,000 for municipal shared costs. In addition to that, it includes our projections for the infrastructure costs, which I believe is 1.2, Jim, correct me if I'm incorrect. And you will not, if you were looking at our budget, you would not see an increase in our budget, but the governor has asked us to cover that within the increment.
So 2.2 million, roughly.
Roughly.
Yeah. Representative John, follow up.
And it's a little different issue. When we, as I was going through some of the material, it said that we would not be compatible with another state who brought their radios up here without some programming, mm-hmm. that, et cetera, and that we maintained a surplus or I can't remember what the term was, that we have radios that we would give to first responders who happen to come up for firefighting or earthquake or anything else. How many of those do we have in reserve, or are we using those and we just pull them from our staff to supply those first responders from out of state in the event of an emergency?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I'm going to let Jim answer the how many question, but you may have been out of the room when we were talking about a recent exercise where we were working with, I think it was Oregon, state of Oregon, as well as Mounties in British Columbia, and you're right, it does take programming to make that work, but that's why we are testing the system and getting those protocols figured out now. Jim, can you address the how many we have in reserve?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. There is no one single warehouse where we have the handsets. These handsets are cached in across different stakeholders, etc. There are approximately, I'm rounding this number generously, there's approximately, I would say, push comes to shove, 1,000 handsets that are out there that we could make available if we had to, without taking handsets from existing users who are on the system. Many of these are cached by the Department of Defense or other places for a large-scale emergency. So we have significant number of handsets we use for test purposes, etc. But we could ultimately bring together about 1,000 handsets without relying on taking a handset from an individual user.
Mr. Chairman,
okay, and one follow-up.
And how long does it take if the state of Washington comes up here and we've got a massive emergency, they've got 300 handsets, we've allocated our 1,000, we're in a Haiti situation. How long would it take to program a handset to be able to use our system?
If I could, Mr. Chairman, it takes approximately 10 to 15 minutes to program and get a handset onto a system. Okay. If someone brought it up from the outside.
And Mr. Chairman, the same would be converse if we took ours outside to respond to a forest fire, which is probably a more likely situation. We seem to send more people out than we bring in. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just listening, this is such a great program. However, I'm seeing a flaw in it just a little bit, and maybe not, but there are lots and lots of volunteer fire departments and medical services, and maybe the medical services would be able to do it, but a lot of our volunteer fire departments are totally volunteer, and they don't have any money, I think the government should have said, well, before we give something to somebody, we're going to make sure that they can maintain them. And my thoughts are, how in the world, if they're very expensive to maintain, how in the world are all of these little areas going to maintain? I mean, was the question ever asked, you know, you have to maintain them or anything like that? Because I was on a volunteer medic, you know, I was an EMT when I was in TOC, and I know what happens when the handsets, you got one that doesn't work. It gets set up on a shelf because there's no money to fix it, so it gets set up on a shelf, and if they're using these all the time and they drop them and, you know, all kinds of things happen. I'm just wondering, how expensive is it to maintain them? And I would like to know that. I know it depends on what's the matter with it, but I mean, does it have to be sent in? Does somebody come around and check them every once in a while? I mean, I don't know. And so could you just kind of answer that?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman, excellent question. I will tell you from experience that of the approximate 4,000 or so handsets that the state of Alaska maintains through the Alaska Troopers, Department of Transportation, DNR, etc. We will see perhaps 10 to 15 of those a year that have some malfunction that need a repair. So the cost of maintenance and repair on a particular handset can easily run a few hundred dollars if it doesn't work and you have to get it fixed because of a circuit or a chip or some kind of a thing. But the handsets are very reliable, and so the amount of dollars ultimately that, you know, any particular community or entity needs to spend on an annual basis maintaining these radios is very, very, very small. On the other note, though, going back to an earlier question on the number of handsets cached and available, if any entity, state of Alaska entity with us, even if it was a local entity, said, you know, two of our handsets aren't working, we have to send them in to repair, we can work with that community, take a couple of the handsets from the cache unit so that they can maintain their radio quantity until such time as they can get their system back.
Okay.
And thank you very much. It's a very interesting topic that involves all of our communities, and so we appreciate that. And we will, within the next couple days, each member that has specific questions, we'll send those to the Representative Lynn's office, and then we'll get those to you. And depending upon the nature of those written responses, or we might ask you to come back for a follow-up on the overview if there's things, and you can request that as well if you think there's any things that are being asked that you need to clarify for the public.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. We're happy to answer them in writing. We'll look forward to doing that. As technical, so in writing is a great thing. Also happy to meet with any of you individually if you should have any other questions. Happy to walk you through more detailed question answers.
And thank you very much for coming. And our next item is the Commissioner of Department of Environmental Conservation. And he's here for a review of the committee's of his qualifications as Lieutenant Governor Designee, as his nomination has been forwarded to us. And so, welcome, Commissioner Hartig. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and go ahead and proceed with the short introduction of yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Seaton. My name is Larry Hartig. I currently serve as the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I've been in that position for 3 years now, and prior to being at the Department of Conservation, I was in private practice in Anchorage for 23 years, doing mostly environmental, natural resource, and commercial transactions. And prior to that, I was in law school in Portland, Oregon, going to night school, and during the day, I had several different jobs. My last job there, I was a regional underwriter for Safeco Title Insurance Company, in charge of underwriting, training, and auditing for 23 branches and agencies they had around the state. Prior to that, I was head of high liability transactions for Multnomah County and Portland for the same company. Prior to that, I lived on the Kenai. I was in Kenai and managing a title company there with a branch office in Homer. Traveling back regularly between Kenai and Homer for about a year and a half, and prior to that was I was working summers. That was taking me all the way back to college now, going back a long ways here, but that was back in Alaska again. And I was at that time I had two different jobs. One is I worked for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Project for a contractor, doing land work and in the land legal department of Alyeska Pipeline for a contractor on acquisition of everything from gravel to right-of-ways to campsites and permits for that project. And then I had also worked for a title company doing title work in Anchorage for a short while. So that's the background. I have only been in public service 3 years, and it's a great experience. I really enjoy my job. I'm working all over the state with communities. I think that's what I enjoy best, is working with communities, helping them solve problems. And it's a real honor and privilege to be nominated by the governor as the Lieutenant Governor successor. I hope I never have to fulfill that duty, but it's an honor to be asked, at least to be standing in the wings if needed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And could you just describe for the committee how you view the obligations of the job for which you're being nominated?
Yes, Chairman Seaton, I have researched that a bit. I had discussions, of course, initially with the governor and then with the Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell, and asked him to walk me through the duties of the Lieutenant Governor. I also was given several briefing papers that had originally been prepared for him about the duties of the Lieutenant Governor. I think the primary one, particularly looking at the time period, you know, that we are talking about here, you know, where if I did succeed to the Lieutenant Governor, you know, what I would be faced with. And of course, the main task would be overseeing the Division of Elections and the fact that we have an election coming up in the fall. So that would be the primary task, is to make sure that there's fair and open elections in Alaska, you know, this fall. In addition to that, you know, there's the initiative process. The Lieutenant Governor has a role in that. The Lieutenant Governor has a role in the filing of regulations, and then, of course, keeping the state seal. And those are and making sure that notaries get appointed. There's over 30,000 notaries in the state. And all of these ultimately are administrative duties, but critical duties, and particularly, I think, the election and the time period that we're in, that to me would be the primary concern.
Okay, thank you. We have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question to you right now is just, how does this work? Do you keep your present job and continue doing what you're doing now, and then if something happens, you just drop that and go over there? Or how does this process work?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, my understanding of the process is that the governor identifies somebody as the Lieutenant Governor's successor, and you stay in your current job. You know, there's no immediate duties, you know, associated with that designation. But in the event the current Lieutenant Governor is unable to serve, then you automatically go into that position. Again, that would be subject to the governor's will. If the governor changed his mind or her mind at that point in time and decided to designate somebody else, subject to confirmation by the legislature, they're free to do that. But otherwise, you step in and you assume the duties of the lieutenant governor until that position is filled through a special election.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Just one follow-up question. And in the meantime, I'm thinking of, because the importance of the election's coming up, you go over and talk with him once in a while and kind of get a feel of what's going on so that if you had to step in, you could, or you just wing it?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I certainly wouldn't wing it. The last thing I'd want to do if I did succeed to lieutenant governor, I would not be winging it. It would be, I know all eyes would be on me to make sure it was a successful election, and you don't get a second chance. It has to go right everywhere in the state. But the answer to a specific question is, I anticipate, I have good relations with the governor and lieutenant governor, that, you know, I would be seeking direction from them, you know, as to, if there are any critical things that, you know, I should be aware of, that in the eventuality, you know, of an emergency and I had to step in, that I'd be prepared to do that. And I talked with Lieutenant Governor just on Sunday. He was getting ready to leave town, checked in with me to see if there's anything, questions I had, you know, preparing for this hearing. And he offered, he said, at any point in time, you know, to sit down with me and walk me through, you know, his duties and, you know, what was on the plate. So I'm anticipating that, there would be good coordination there. And one of the advantages here is, in listening to the last presentation, it sounds very familiar to me because I'm one of the organizations that's a response organization, of course, on environmental problems. And I know that Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell has his experience through Military and Veterans Affairs on emergency response. So both of us have a mind that works like that, you know, on disaster preparedness and being prepared.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think it's fair that I disclose that the commissioner is a constituent. I'm very happy to see you here. I've seen him door to door. And I highly recommend him. I think he's a great choice. But I think, just as a little advice, the next few months, do everything you can do to keep the lieutenant governor and the governor safe. I think the best advice I can give you, but congratulations, and I'm happy to see you there. So thank you, Mr. Yeah. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And Commissioner Hartig, following up on the Division of Elections, I know that's a prime responsibility. Do you view the lieutenant governor's position with elections as being the getting in and running the elections, or is that the Division of Elections and the director, and is that the lieutenant governor's job primarily to make sure that there's a good setup ahead of time?
As you say, Chairman Seaton, I believe that the lieutenant governor's responsibility is to make sure that the director of elections is an experienced, capable person that's dedicated to the task at hand, and that person is given the resources they need, you know, to perform. And that includes making sure there's good communication with all the other people that help in the various communities to make sure that when an election happens, everything happens well. But the lieutenant governor certainly is not the one that gets in there and tries to steer anything one way or the other. You know, it's hands off. You just make sure that the resources are there, the capable people are there, and then make it happen.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? I had a question on regulations. Of course, one of the, and I talked to you yesterday about this, but I think that for the public, we need to make sure that these conversations also take place fully around the table, and that is that the lieutenant governor signs off on regulations. And can you discriminate between the types of regulations that are signed and when, what regulations you would have some ability to influence and those that you are basically starting the clock on, and then how you would handle each of those?
Yes, Chairman Seaton, the lieutenant governor's position regarding regulations is administrative. They're not a gatekeeper. That the role of the lieutenant governor is to make sure that you know, when the regulations come to Lieutenant Governor for filing, that they've gone through the process, and the Department of Law does the final review, both substantively and procedurally, you know, to make sure that they're written correctly in the state form and that the public process was followed, and then they recommend them for filing, you know, with the agency to the Lieutenant Governor. So it's not a gatekeeper function where the Lieutenant Governor reviews and says, you know, this passes, this doesn't, by any means. You know, the public process is over. It would be inappropriate at that point to, you know, exert your personal will in it. But I think that the Lieutenant Governor could, you know, if this was something that the governor's office wanted, when the process initially starts, you know, to look at those and try to identify those that, you know, may need some additional input from, you know, a policy perspective or financial perspective, and highlight those for the governor's office and for the agency themselves that, you know, these may need some additional scrutiny as you go through the process. But at the end of the day, you're not the gatekeeper.
Okay. Thank you. And you know, it's very important with agency regulations, I think, that people know what's coming down the line. And, you know, part of the problem is that an agency can have a tunnel vision, and then the Department of Law says, well, these regulations you propose, even if they're contrary to all the public opinion, the Department of Law says they're not illegal. So there has to be some of that function, whereas it's raised to back to the agency or to the governor. And finding out whether there's that ability. Otherwise, everything just is on autopilot through agencies. So I appreciate that. And are there any other questions for the successor designate? Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Through the chair, Mr. Hardig, Commissioner Hardig, you're a very well-respected member of the bar, and I'm very glad that you're serving in the administration and that you've been designated.
Thank you.
Good luck.
And so do I have a motion to move to the floor for consideration that these, you have the...
I've got the language. Sheet.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that the State Affairs Committee report out to review the qualification for the governor's appointee and recommends that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration, that being the name of Lawrence L. Harding for Lieutenant Governor's successor. Also point out that this does not reflect the intent of any member to vote for or against the individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
And is there any objection? Seeing none, we do have a signature sheet that will come around. Thank you very much, Commissioner Harding, for joining us this morning and for your patience for a long overview hearing we had, but it was on a...
Well, thank you, Chairman, and I did enjoy the presentation. I learned something. Thank you, members.
We will take just a brief at ease here before we proceed on before us, which is HB 76.
The House State Affairs Committee will, I'd like to thank you. Vice Chair Seaton for helping me during my absence to testify another bill, which, by the way, passed out of committee. Our next item on the agenda is a CS for House Bill 76, and I'd like somebody to make a motion to adopt the CS.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair. Well, since you're testifying, let's do it from up here.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt as a working document LS 0335/S is our working document.
Okay. Without objection?
I'll second.
Okay. We're working with CS for House Bill number 76. Representative Gruenberg, we'd like to, we're going to go as far as we can here. Would you like to introduce your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you very much for scheduling it as the first order of business this year. I think in the last legislature, it may have been just about the last order of business in the 25th legislature, as the members who were on the committee at the time may recall.
Guy, just my time out, but just a moment. Would you try to get hold of Gatto and Johnson? Okay, continue, please.
The bill is quite simple. it provides parity and fairness with respect to the makeup of the Ledge Council and legislative budget and audit. In approximately, I believe, 1988, we adopted amendments to Uniform Rule 1, which applied to all of the standing committees, not the joint committees, but the standing committees, at the request of the minority leader at the time. We did not have any coalitions in the House.
And who was the majority leader at that time?
Myself. The minority leader was Fritz Pettyjohn from Anchorage, who was a great guy, and we miss him. He came up to me, if I may anecdotally say, one day on the floor and said, you know, it's not fair that we don't have proportional representation on the committees, and that we only have a right to one person on every standing committee, when at the time I believe there were 16 members of the minority, Republicans, and 24 Democrats in the majority. And we in the leadership and in the majority caucus thought about that a bit, and we were persuaded that it was an unfairness and an injustice. And so we amended Rule 1, and you all have in your Uniform Rules, there's the chart, depending upon the size of the committee, and it's in your documents here. We did not include at that time the joint committees. There are three joint committees, or the ones that are relevant here, are Legislative Budget and Audit, Ledge Council, and Joint Armed Services, which, by the way, we haven't put Armed Services in this bill because it's not really a committee that does the same kind of work the others do. I did not remember, and we could not find in the bill history, any reason for not including or any discussion why these two committees were not included. Bill Stoltz was a staff member, and he's got a pretty good memory, and he frankly jogged my memory that I think maybe one of the reasons it was not, and these were not included at the time, was probably because it was felt that they were a little more, Ledge Council was felt it was a little more political, and that they didn't want to get into it at the time. Here we're 20 years later, and I think it's time we have full parity. And I'm speaking on behalf of the members of the minority. Our newest member, we haven't talked to about this yet, and so his name isn't on it, but I plan to ask him if he'd like to join, and I would welcome any members of the majority to join on this too, because politics comes and goes, and the Democrats happen to be in the minority around here at this time. That may not always be the case. I expect it probably won't. And it's something that's just to provide fairness. And I think, looking back on my time in the leadership, when I'm an older man, and look back on what I did in the legislature, I think I'm going to look on that as one of the better things we did, because it made the system work better. And I think that this would make the system work better, too. I appreciated your motion, Representative Seaton, to adopt the CS and the fact that the members adopted that, because it contains an applicability clause at the end, which makes it clear that the bill will not apply until the next legislature, because we don't want to upset anything in the middle of the legislature. And it's just simply a matter of fairness. The world is not going to go away, or crises will not occur if it's not adopted. But I think it's symbolic. The people in this state and in this country, I think, look for fairness and bipartisanship. And I would say this whether I was in the majority or the minority, that people want us to work together. And this is as much a symbolic statement of that as anything else. And I would hope we'd put politics aside and stand on the side of good government's fairness and equity and pass this out.
Okay. Any questions? Reverend Garner, do you have any comments or questions?
I have been thinking about them, and I'm not sure that, first of all, we have all our committees except these two have proportional representation. But the fact that Ledge Council meets outside of the normal session, I'm trying to look for some justification that says it's more important to have proportional representation than not. And your statement was it's a fairness issue. But is that enough of a reason, a fairness issue, or is it important for the majority party who will be enacting some, making some very serious decisions to maybe have an overweighted presence? I'm looking, and my personal feeling is that right now I'm not ready to support this in this direction until I've had some more time. And so I need more time to look at it. Thank you.
Representative Peterson, any comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I look at it from the point of view that we're all represented, elected to represent districts of more or less equal size. And so when there is a small number from one political party in a given committee, that maybe some of the people from that member's district may not have equal representation that that they deserve, and I do think it is a fairness issue, and I think all committees. It seems to me like if we're going to do it for the committees that are set up that way now, that we should do it for all the committees. Okay. Thank you,
Representative Wilson. Any comment?
Not right now.
Okay. Representative Vice Chair Seaton.
Thank you. Kind of dovetailing off of Representative Peterson's question about political parties, it seems that the bill that we have before us actually takes away the requirement that he talked about, because if we look at the Senate, you would have a minority and a majority that both contain people of the same political party. So you could end up with a Ledge Council, members of minority, majority, all of the same political party. And this is removing the requirement that there be at least one member of the opposite political party, because it's saying that's a requirement on page 1, line 9, include at least one member from each of the two major political parties, and that's being removed. And it's saying the majority, the Senate president, who might, or the other body's president, is of a part of the Republican Party, and it could be that the appointees to that body would be Republicans from the majority. There are only Republicans in the minority, and so you could end up with all members from that body being of one political party, because we've removed the requirement in this bill that there be a member of the other political party on Ledge Council and Legislative Budget and Audit. And so I want to make sure that we distinguish between minority and majority with the working groups and all that we have now, and in both the House and the Senate and the other body, we have bipartisan majority. And so we get to this section where we need to be clear that what we're saying here is we are removing the requirement in this law that there be someone from the other, from the minority political party, or not necessarily minority political party, from one person at least from each political party. That's what we're removing from this statute, and we're substituting the idea of majority and minority of unaffiliated political parties, just that they've organized as majority and minority. And so I guess that was more of a statement, but I would like to direct that as a question to Representative Gruenberg, that isn't that the effect of what we have on page one, line nine, the excluded language?
Yeah, may I? So it is now 10 o'clock. This is a weighty subject. And I will commit to hearing this bill again. But I don't think it's fair to the committee or to you to continue on, because this is a serious. If before we hear this bill again, and we will hear the bill again, if you could come back with an answer to that and or perhaps some amendment to this.
The answer to your question.
And I'm actually inviting you to make an amendment. Can you believe it?
The answer to your question is a yes.
Perhaps.
Just, if I may say one sentence. With respect to Representative Seaton's question, I believe the language covers your problem, and I'll check with Tam Cook, who helped draft this. And if we need an amendment, we will do that to accomplish this, and I will commit to you to that. And with respect to Representative Gatto's concern, we'll chat, but I'll put that on the record in a very succinct way when we reconvene.
Also, and on the effective date, we're going to have reapportionment in 2012. It could be an entirely different composition of the legislature throughout the state. And also, Representative Wilson, I believe, has a bill we're going to be hearing one of these days on potentially enlarging the legislature, correct? And so that could have some effect on this. And maybe you two could...
I think they're separate. I really...
Well, they are separate. But if we do, in fact, at some point enlarge the legislature, it could change the math on it, I think. I don't know. But... I'd like to thank you for bringing that forward. I do understand, to me at least, that there's some element of fairness on this, but we have to meld fairness and practicality. But I will hear this again. I apologize for the break in the continuity here in the committee meeting today. It's my fault. I had to go the other side. Before the next, so I'm going to hold... this bill for another hearing, CS for House Bill 6. And on Thursday, January 28th, we'll be hearing HB 53, which is candidates ineligible for boards and commissions. I believe that's Representative Dugan's bill. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And so we'll be hearing that. And you'll be happy to know I'm not... much as you might like to hear this bill again, let's don't do it on a Saturday for a while.
No.
But I'd like to thank you very much, and with that, we'll adjourn at about 5 after 10.